My name is Andrew Hunter. I'm the senior curator at the Art Gallery of Guelph, and I'm here today with
Jen Budney.
And we're sitting in Jen's kitchen in her home here in beautiful Saskatoon. It is gray and windy and dusty.
It's very dusty today.
Yeah, we've known each other for a while. You work galleries, but in recent years has really focused on PhD work and just finished your PhD. So we're going to talk about your thesis, but I want to back up and just ask you to talk a bit about your background and how did you end up here? And we're also being joined by your lovely daughter, who's supposed to be weaving in the other room. And you'll also hear some panting occasionally, and that's Zora. He's 15 years old.
Mm-hmm. And a border collie.
And a border collie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not... none of us are panting. Okay. So tell us about yourself. Where do you come from?
So I was born in Saskatoon, actually, and I grew up between Australia and Edmonton. I went to art school, started art school at the age of 21 at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. Did a year and a half long exchange at Cooper Union in New York, and then moved to Milan, Italy for 5 years, where I worked at Flash Art Magazine and wrote for an array of international art magazines. And when I moved back to Canada when I was almost 30 years old, it was partly because I realized I needed more education to write about some of the things that I was interested in, and I didn't have the vocabulary to explore as fully as I wanted to. And also, I had grown weary of the international art market and the kind of strategizing and the individualism of that scene. So I wanted to be back in a place where I could find myself with community, and that was difficult for me to do in Italy. So I came back to Canada and moved to Ottawa, where I started working at Gallery 101.
Right.
My 8-year-old daughter has a question.
Yes. You could introduce yourself as well.
My question is, who are you talking to? There are only two people here.
But we're recording it because this is going to be played on the radio in Guelph, and it's also going to be a podcast that you'll be able to listen to online. So you'll be able to share this with, you'll be able to hear it and family and friends and that.
So
okay?
I'm introducing myself?
You can introduce yourself, yeah.
My name is Alexia.
Yeah, and then what was your favorite joke that you liked to play with me when you were about 2 years old? You would say, Mom, every time I say...
contemporary art.
What would I have to do?
Bite my nose.
Yeah.
So, yeah, contemporary art, bite your nose. That seems appropriate.
Yeah, so run off and go do the weaving now, and I'm going to keep talking. Okay.
101.
Gallery 101. And that was really fun. I worked with Stéphane Saint-Laurent there for a couple of years and also with François Dion. And at the same time that I was working at Gallery 101, I started a master's degree in anthropology at Carleton University, anthropology and sociology. My research took place in Brazil, and I was able to, through my research, sort of answer a question that had been bothering me, having been part of the international art world during the heyday of globalization when it was first taking place. I'm going to backtrack. When I started working at Flash Art Magazine, Flash Art Magazine was the biggest art magazine on the market. And that's partly because the owners, Giancarlo Politti and Helena Kontova, had built up a network of global connections since the late 1960s throughout Eastern Europe, through the Soviet bloc, in China, in Latin America. They traveled a lot, they'd made connections, and they had, although, you know, some people argue that they're crazy, they had the insight that art was important wherever it was taking place, that the New York market was not the only market that mattered.
Right.
And so when I went to Flash Art, this was before the age of internet. And we had dozens of correspondents around the world, who most of whom were writing in English as a second language, who would fax us their reviews. And sometimes they were handwritten, sometimes they were typed. But one of my jobs every morning was to go to the fax machine and see what reviews and articles had come in through the machine. And I'd walk them down the hall to our Hungarian typist, who only spoke Hungarian and Italian. And she would type in these English language reviews and commentaries, and then put them on a floppy disk and walk them down the hall to me, where I would edit them. So that was one of my jobs. In the 5 years that I was living in Italy, This is when, in 1996, really was the beginning of, which was the second year I was in Italy, was the beginning of this thing called globalization. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly we were dealing with, our magazine was the place where a lot of those dialogues were taking place at the time, because we had contacts in Africa, because we had contacts in Latin America, in China. Mm-hmm. And so some of the people who I was working with quite closely during those years were Okwi Nwizer and Ho Hanru, and people who ended up becoming very, super curators, I guess was the term. Yeah. But they were just emerging art writers and curators at the time. Flash art now is quite irrelevant because all magazines, thanks to the internet, have been able to create these global connections. But in those days, it was a really different kind of scene. But because we were so central, because Flash Art Magazine was so central to all of these discussions at the time, I had opportunities to travel to the Johannesburg Biennial and in Okwi's, the one that Okwi did in 1997, to Cuba to see various iterations of cities on the move that Ho Hanru and Hans Rolf Obrist did, and to meet a lot of the international globalized artists that were making headlines. And I started to notice that in certain places there were kind of discrepancies between what was being promoted in terms of globalization and equity and opportunity and what it looked like when you got up close. And I worked closely in those years with an artist named Maria Teresa Alves, a Brazilian artist and activist who comes from a poor, mostly mixed but indigenous family in Brazil, and had been raised by her parents from the age of 8 in the U.S., where they went to be agricultural workers. And she said to me at one point, I'd love to do a photo installation at the São Paulo Biennale, where I could put photographs of all the Brazilian artists on one wall, and across from that, photographs of all the support workers, the cleaners, the guards, everybody else at the São Paulo. And you see a wall of white faces and a wall of black faces. Mm-hmm. She said, but I don't actually have the evidence to back that up. Those are all my personal observations, but I have no evidence for that. So when I got to Ottawa, I did my degree in anthropology, and my research looked at how the gatekeepers to the Brazilian contemporary art system explained or justified the complete exclusion of black artists from the contemporary art system, because there are two parallel art worlds there. There's the contemporary art world, and then there's the Afro-Brazilian art world. Mm-hmm. And although the work that was being done in the Afro-Brazilian art world was just as sophisticated, as conceptual, and as nuanced as the work being done in the white contemporary art world, they were never shown in the same place. That was a really interesting experience for me, was to listen to people. I think I had an advantage because I'm white, and so they trusted me, and they talked about their perceptions of what was appropriate for art, what could speak and who could speak in a term that was used quite often, a universal language. And so it was a study of whiteness in part, but how those particular cultural values infuse institutions, infuse our institutions and possibilities for other people. So that's always been a big interest of mine, and it dates back to my time at Flash Art Magazine, making those observations. Also, I come from a household where I did not grow up going to art galleries. When I graduated from high school, I didn't know who Picasso was.
Right.
So I felt some kind of affinity to communities that were not part of that museum gallery culture.
Right.
After that, I got my master's degree in 2002, so it was 10 years before I started my PhD again. And I after Gallery 101, I went to the Canada Council for the Arts for a couple of years, and then decided to get out of the policy world, and I wanted to see if I could make contemporary art speak to or speak with non-art audiences. And so I went to the Kamloops Art Gallery, Andrew.
Yeah, where I had been.
Yeah, and tried my best to experiment there for 3 years, and then came to the Mendel Art Gallery in Saskatoon to do the same thing with slightly more opportunities, I guess.
Yeah, and just to clarify, the Mendel Art Gallery is since that time, it has a new building. It's been rebranded, renamed. It's the Remy Modern.
Remy Modern. Yeah.
Okay, and that might come up in the other parts of this conversation. But that was great. I hadn't heard you talk about the Flash Art years, and I think a lot about. I am older than you, but I do think back to those pre-internet days and how things worked in artist-run centers in the art world, and how we would communicate and how things came about and how we connected. But let's jump ahead to now and your decision to do your PhD. Yeah, talk about what made you decide to go back in and do PhD work, to do that kind of academic work? And what was it that you wanted to address?
So I had tried to initiate a lot of different kinds of programming to engage communities in different ways as a curator working in art museums. And I found myself, especially at the Mendel Art Gallery, working in affinity with the education department mm-hmm. increasingly, and really having a lot of conversations with these really amazing women who staff those departments, who had been, you know, underpaid and undervalued for years and years, but had really had their pulse on the public in mm-hmm. a way that became clear to me that curators and directors not only don't have, but don't have to have, because
they often don't want to have.
Their validation doesn't come from the public. Their validation comes from their peers across the country. And I realized that the kinds of programs that I was initiating involved a great deal of struggle, having to sort of have the organization change its rules, and you know, sometimes it would be met with a fair amount of displeasure or just discomfort in the organization trying to get those sorts of projects working with youth, bringing people into the collection, whatever the different projects were. And at that same time, the Mendel was gearing up to expand, to transform itself into the Remy Modern, into a building the five times the size, with a different set of ambitions. And I was actually on mat leave with my son, looking around at what had happened to some other Canadian art museums who had recently undergone expansions or you know, new buildings altogether, like the Art Gallery of Windsor, the Art Gallery of Alberta, the Rooms, and even a different, I guess it wasn't a new building, but it was board's new interest in engaging broader publics with the Musée d'Art Contemporain in Montreal.
Right.
And the kind of turmoil with, in the case of the first three, the inability for these expanded organizations to meet their audience targets, and the sort of long-term, like, I guess, disabling of the organizations to even engage communities, because they had to do such radical cutbacks in staff or get emergency bailout funding, or, you know, resort to just bringing in exhibitions from the National Gallery, whatever it is they had to do. And I thought, this does not bode well. I don't want to be one of those, like the Art Gallery of Windsor, which laid off almost all of its staff.
Yeah.
You know, they went from 19 to 5, something like that. So I don't want to be in that position in a few years. And so I thought, I need a plan B. Yeah. But also, by then, I realized that I felt like the best I was doing was sort of putting Band-Aids on things. Yeah. And I wanted to have a deeper understanding of why art museums seem to be so reluctant and so unable to engage broader publics. Even when they claim that they are there to serve the public. I mean, they get public funding because they're there to serve the public, but the publics that they get are very elitist, and they are very small, and they are shrinking. And we have very poor data in Canada, but even the most recent data I could find back then, which was in about 2012 from Canadian Heritage, was that the absolute numbers of visitors to art museums in Canada is shrinking. So, and in the United States, it's clear. In terms of absolute numbers, there are fewer visitors to art museums now, and those visitors are increasingly white. So there's less diversity. You know, black and Hispanic visitors are declining in numbers at a much more rapid rate than white visitors. They're much better educated than the general public, the audiences are, much wealthier. And so to me, this seems like a kind of public value failure. A failure to deliver public value. And if we are relegating the engagement of non-elite publics to underfunded, under-resourced education departments, and still upholding, I guess, the supremacy of the curatorial vision, which is always very subjective and requires usually a great deal of education to engage with, it seems to me that art museum may be there, maybe here, to do something other than what it claims to be doing, which is serving the public. And I wanted to figure that out. So I was lucky that there's a great public policy school at the University of Saskatchewan. And I applied. I was accepted. I got a big scholarship. And away I went. And it was the best thing I ever did. It was so great.
So you started that in 2012?
In 2013.
2013. And you've just finished.
Yep.
Your thesis has an interesting title. So maybe just say what the title is and then explain the meaning of that.
So my thesis is called The Imbecile Institution and the Limits of Public Engagement, Art Museums and Structural Barriers to Public Value Creation. The term imbecile institution.
So let's talk about imbecile. What an imbecile institution.
That term I borrowed from the 19th century economist Thorstein Veblen, who was a son of Norwegian immigrants, kind of renegade cultural economist, who wrote The Theory of the Leisure Class. That was his most famous book, where he coined the term conspicuous consumption. Mm-hmm. So he was a critic of American culture. He used that term only once in passing to refer to a set of institutions by which he referred not only to actual organizational structures, formal institutions, but also habits and cultural values, things that endure over time through a culture.
Right.
And so for Veblen, the imbecile institutions were first neoclassical economics, this idea which are premised on the idea of the atomistic individual,
right.
And the purely rational, self-interested individual. Patriarchy was another imbecile institution. Women's fashion was an imbecile institution, and the American university. He never provided a strict definition for the imbecile institution, but it's basically, from what I've been able to pull out from his writings, it's an institution which continues to be valued in society, that everyone believes to be eternal and unchanging and right, mm-hmm. even as it clearly deserves the public. And I thought, well, that sounds like the art museum. So I used it for my title. Yeah. And I do draw on Veblen for other parts of my research as well. He was not one of the American pragmatists, but the pragmatists did look to his work. So the writings of John Dewey, of the art museum director and museum critic, John Cotton Dana, Henry James, those were the American pragmatists whose some of their observations are so relevant to today, it's uncanny when you read their work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting, because tell me if this kind of relates in a way, but one of the critiques I've often had of the art museum is that even though it is an art institution, that it often lacks two things. It lacks creativity and it lacks the ability to learn. Mm-hmm. Would you say those are characteristics that factor in? So when that, like one says, the imbecile, it implies, like, in a sense, the inability to
absolutely
grow or learn or change.
Absolutely,
right?
I think you hit the nail on the head there. But I part of it is, if you think about the development of the art museum, is with it's in tandem with the development of industrial organization, and so it has that organizational structure. It's very much a top-down command and control hierarchy. Mm-hmm. That's how art museums were built, because that's how efficient organizations were conceived of in those days.
Right.
And that might work very well for a factory that produces shoes, but for an organization that's supposed to be responding to that its changing environment in a way that is dynamic, in a way that is reflecting culture, especially in a time of very rapid change like the one we're living through, the one that we've lived our whole lives through.
Yeah.
That kind of top-down command and control hierarchy is unable to learn, because information flows only in one direction, and it is therefore not creative.
Yeah.
So I look at things like that, like the structure of the art museum. And I do advocate in my conclusion that we need to have flatter hierarchies. We need to have flatter organizations.
Yeah.
And we need to empower and find a place for the feedback of those individuals who work with the general public on a daily basis, who often can understand the successes and failures of the exhibitions in ways that curators and directors are completely oblivious to.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that, I mean, one of the things that I did discover, my research involved a lot of interviews and surveys with art museum educators, and not all educators see the need for change.
Right.
So it's not a category of a museum employee that is, you know, chomping at the bit necessarily in all places. But that's because, you know, as frontline workers, basically those who are able to tolerate and kind of come to accept the norms of the museum are the ones that last. They're the ones that endure inside the organization. So it's usually in places where there's a lot of the educators are actually given a seat at the table where strategic planning takes place, and there's a leader in place who will who will allow them to make changes. You can see a lot, you get a lot of great ideas from those educators, or educators who are finding themselves in particularly imbecilic institutions. Right. There's been some kind of change in management and they kind of butt their heads up against these brick walls that weren't necessarily there before, and allows them to look critically at what the museum does. And so most of the educators that I interviewed are actually fall somewhere in the middle and are fairly satisfied with art museums. Yeah. So there's not a single hero to this idea of change in art museums.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because I mean, I think we often find that lots of people leave. Lots mm-hmm. of people eventually you move like you did and you move in another direction. And oftentimes it depends on what drew you into the arts in the first place.
Yeah.
We were part of a conversation earlier today where this notion of, for people involved in art museums who engage in a certain type of community-focused practice, often get dismissed as mm-hmm. You're not really engaged with art. This is just social work.
Absolutely.
But for so many of us, mm-hmm. the idea of becoming involved in the arts and galleries and museums was a kind of social work.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, and there's a real... So the art museum educators are almost all women across the country, here and in the U.S., there's a really, the art museum is a very gendered institution, mm-hmm. and it really privileges a masculine idea of success and progress, this mm-hmm. acts of creative destruction. This is how art history has been written.
Right.
And so what, Italian feminists call the labor of social reproduction, all that caretaking that goes on mm-hmm. to build and rebuild communities and publics, the work that is traditionally undertaken by women, that is completely devalued.
Right.
And so I think we need to really, as people working in the field, reflect on those priorities. And so this way that the work that you do, Andrew, can be dismissed as social work, that's coming from, those kinds of criticisms come from a place it's a very gendered bias, right?
Yeah.
That interests me because we think of the art museum as we think of the arts as a field of creativity and radical change and progressiveness and all that, but it's absolutely not.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually very, very conservative.
Yeah.
In every way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all the kids are here.
Yeah.
And so let's maybe just one more question. Talk to me about Saskatoon.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of things that are going on here and what you like about here. Obviously, I put you on the spot because if you decide to say, I don't like anything about
here. No, I love
it
here.
But I get the sense you really love mm-hmm. it here in your little purple house.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe give some examples of some of the things that you like about what's happening in this city that maybe you think other folks should be aware of out there.
Well, I was really pleased to come to Saskatoon because I'd always been aware of the strength of its arts community.
Mm.
And part of it was that for a long time, Saskatoon was a have-not province. And so real estate was cheap. Artists could afford to stay. We're also really far away from any other place. And so people would just stay. So there's a great community here. It's very welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always felt very welcomed here. And it's a community that is big enough that you don't see the same people every day as we did in Kamloops, let's say.
Yes. Yeah.
and small enough that you can't afford to be rude and you can't afford to have cliques. So it's just a lot of people here who friends who have become like family here.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, there's also all kinds of opportunities to be involved in community because it is small enough that you can always find out how to get involved. There's always, you know, things are accessible.
Yeah.
There are a lot of problems in Saskatoon. It's a very racist city.
Yeah.
The levels of inequality here are profound. They're staggering. So there's so much work to be done. But I prefer to be kind of having to do that work as a member of the community than to be oblivious to it by living someplace else where it's not so visible. I think of Saskatoon as a kind of microcosm of the Canada, and the problems that we have here are the problems that all of Canada has, but there we can see them. It's like we're under a bit of a microscope here. We can see them better here.
I was in Glasgow recently mm-hmm. in Scotland. This is a connected to Saskatoon story, and I was walking around with a group of graduate students, and we were standing looking at a statue of a man who was not Tommy Douglas,
mm-hmm.
I want to point out, but he sure looked like Tommy Douglas. So I was telling the students this story about who Tommy Douglas was and, you know, the history of public medical, you know, Medicare and so on. And then I shared, they were mostly younger people, so I said, and he's also the grandfather of mm-hmm. and Kiefer Sutherland, and nobody knew who Kiefer Sutherland
was. Oh, that's good.
But it was just like, and then I went on scrambling about different shows or movies he's been in. Nobody knew what I was talking about.
Yeah. So you just mentioned Tommy Douglas. That's one of the things I like about Saskatchewan is that history of community helping each other here.
Right.
So, you know, the community change, social innovation happens when people feel a need to come together and do something to change whatever circumstances they have around them. And we have that long history here in Saskatchewan with you know, the first arts board in North America is the Saskatchewan Arts Board. The universal health care was invented here. The cooperative movement has been so strong here. So those, that history and that legacy is still here, and it's being threatened all the time by the current government and current, I guess, economic forces. But that's still here, and we can draw on that as a resource, let alone the amazing Indigenous knowledge that's present here and that we're all learning from.
Anything to offer about the new art museum and where you're hoping it's heading? I mean, there is a, like you said at the beginning, there is this, you know, the Mendel, which is a gallery. I mean, my, I worked with the Mendel over a decade ago. It was certainly a gallery that seemed to be very connected with this place. Like, it was very identified with Saskatchewan. It ran the program that took shows all over the province, but also seemed to be really thoughtful and engaged as some other galleries, like the Dunlop at one time in Saskatchewan was also. But it's gone through a change. So where do you see the, you know, again, if you're comfortable talking about it, like, what's the hope for this new building? Or do you see, as you've examined in other cases, where galleries have a constant critique that I've had and you've brought up too, is this like where they get too big, they overgrow. And then with that, suddenly all of the things that you thought were part of their core values or that they said were their core values, like being very public, and engage sort of fall away. Do you think it's sort of like jumped the shark and gotten too big?
Well, yes, I think it is. I think so. I think it's, if you look at other art museums with the same square footage around North America, you'd be looking at double or triple the number of staff and operational budgets that are three times the size or four times four times the size. So it's going to be really, really tough for the museum, for the REMI to meet its targets, all of its financial targets. And that's been my one of my huge concerns for the REMI. My argument has been, in order to do that, in order to succeed, because it's, the business plan is built on, I think, wildly optimistic predictions for tourism to Saskatoon on account of the Picassos. And I just don't see that happening. They've just announced that they have exceeded their 2017 or 2018 audience targets already. But we haven't seen any kind of hard numbers out yet. And so I don't know. I've been there sometimes when it's been really crowded. I've been there sometimes when it's empty. They need to have, you know, basically an average of 700 people a day to meet their attendance targets. So my argument has been that it will need to really engage the local community in really original ways in order to succeed, that it can't rely on international tourists. I don't see that happening under current leadership, although I know that amongst staff there's a huge will to do that, but it it can be hard if you're not being supported at the top. And so I think it's really wait and see. Ellen Ramey, the museum's patron, may be in a position to bail the REMI out should it fail to meet its financial targets. But that can only last so long. So at a certain point, it needs to become self-sufficient. And and we are a very small population to fill that very big gallery. So I don't know how it plans on doing that.
You know, it's a long way to come to see Picasso's, and it's not necessarily a place you come to see Picasso because there's so many other remarkable things to engage with here, right? And the strength of these institutions ultimately will be in the community connections and the stories that they tell, which are from this place, right? So it's really good to see you.
So good to see you, Andrew.
And I really appreciate Spur of the Moment offering the insight. I'm really excited to read your PhD.
I will send it to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah.